The matter of Paul Barilla et al. Versus the Board of Education of Cliffside Park. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Stephen R. Cleary, from Property and Power, here on behalf of Cliffside Park Board of Education.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Robert Rice, on behalf of the New Jersey School Board Association.
Good afternoon, Mr. Richard A. Friedman, Sally, Joe, and the last high down in the region.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Fogarty.
Good afternoon, justices. May it please the court, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Fine.
So this case asks the question whether or not the parties to a collective negotiations agreement are free to negotiate over sick leave balances from one contract to another. In this case, the Cliffside Park Board of Education and the Cliffside Park Education Association negotiated a successor collective negotiations agreement in which the parties both agreed that the sick leave balances should be adjusted. The adjustment resulted in a reduction in the payment for accumulated sick leave from $25,000 to $15,000, with a further adjustment to increase the per diem payout for those sick days. After the contract was negotiated, the parties signed a memorandum of agreement. The contract was overwhelmingly ratified by the Cliffside Park Education Association. Ultimately, the contract was approved by the Board of Education and then subsequently implemented.
Why isn't it just prospective rather than retroactive?
The parties negotiated for the reduction to be retroactive. They negotiated for the change in the sick leave balances to be retroactive. And I think it's also important to note that in negotiating that, there were quid pro quos. So the per diem rate was increased for all employees, including those who would benefit from that prospectively, those currently employed. There was also an agreement to increase the overall salary increase to be distributed to all members on the salary guide. So the point to be made was that the parties understood that this was not prospective only. The transcript of the union president clearly indicates that that was something that was discussed and debated and ultimately determined to be fair in terms of the overall contract settlement which was reached between the parties. So I would respectfully submit that there's no legal obligation to impose a prospective application of that change in terms and conditions of employment. That the Cliffside Park Education Association, pursuant to the statute under the Employer-Employee Relations Act, had full authority to negotiate on behalf of its members.
Is the contract that clear? If you look at the savings, I'm looking at the savings clause. I'll read its two sentences.
I'm familiar with it.
You're familiar with it.
I am.
Unless otherwise provided in this agreement, nothing contained herein shall be interpreted and or applied so as to eliminate, reduce, or otherwise detract from any teacher benefit existing prior to the effective date of this agreement. That's the language.
Yes.
If we assume that sick pay is a form of deferred compensation, it's a right, but it can be waived. Does this language create ambiguity as to whether or not it has been waived, and whether or not this should not be read to eliminate, reduce, or otherwise detract that deferred compensation?
Justice Alvin, I would respectfully submit to you that the Savings Clause protects those rights unless and until the parties agree to change them. And the duration clause of this contract, which was overlooked by the Appellate Division, clearly indicates that the rights and benefits of this contract were to continue until a successor negotiations agreement was agreed upon by the parties. And so I would submit to you that the Savings Clause ultimately protects those rights until there is a knowing and voluntary agreement and a waiver of those rights, and that when this successor agreement was negotiated by the majority representative, that was a knowing and voluntary waiver. And the duration of this contract indicated...
But you're being a lot clearer than this contract. So I know that you're saying that the intention was to make a prospective. This collective negotiation agreement could have put that specific language in. And if deferred compensation is a form of a right, some form of right, and there has to be a clear and explicit waiver, why isn't the argument being made by your adversaries that this is far from clear and explicit, not a winning argument? And I'm not talking about a clear waiver from the individual. I'm talking about from the representative who actually, you know, worked out this agreement with your side.
Well, I believe that that language, Justice Alvin, protects the rights and benefits of employees for the duration of the agreement until those who benefit from that provision make a decision to change those terms and conditions of employment, and in this case, prospectively. And it was the Cliffside Park Education Association, it was the majority representative that made that determination, fully understanding that that savings clause protected those benefits unless and until a new contract was negotiated.
There's nothing explicit in the successor agreement that says that those few employees who had acquired over $15,000 and up to $25,000 in sick days would lose it in the next contract. We have the language in the savings clause. I'm not sure what it means. I'm throwing this out. I'm not certain what it means. But nothing shall be interpreted to eliminate, reduce, or otherwise detract from a benefit existing. Was that a benefit existing? And where is it in this contract that says that it wasn't a benefit existing?
I think that it was a benefit existing. I think that all of the benefits in the contract that intimately affect employees are existing for the term of that contract. And when you ask me your first question, when you ask me where is it in the successor agreement that there was a specific waiver of that benefit, I would submit to you that the successor agreement was very clear that benefit was to have a retroactive effect. That benefit was to be prospective for all employees who retired or separated from the school district. That it was incumbent upon the union, upon the majority representative, to carve out an exception if that's what was intended. The transcript of the union president clearly indicates that she understood full well what the implications were of that provision of the successor agreement.
Why wasn't it your obligation as well? If it is deferred compensation and can only be done away with by clear and explicit waiver, you know, why wasn't the obligation as much yours as the union representatives to make certain that the language was clear in this agreement that those people who had acquired over $15,000 would not be able to use it, would not be able to retire with that benefit into the next contract?
Well, two issues, Justice Alvin, that you raised with me. First, is it deferred compensation? I do not necessarily agree that it is deferred compensation. However, with regard to what our concomitant responsibility might have been, our responsibility as the public employer was to make it clear as to what that benefit was for future retirees. And I believe that that was made abundantly clear in the contract. And I do not believe there was any misunderstanding on the part of the majority representative that is exactly what was intended. I don't think anyone can make a serious argument here that they did not fully understand that concession that they made in exchange for other concessions was going to be imposed on anyone who retired or separated or who was deceased during the term of the contract.
You've argued that the 2012 CNA did not create a vested right. If it did, assume for this question that it did, can a majority of the union abrogate that retroactively?
Chief Justice, I would submit to you that they can, that they have the ability to negotiate on behalf of their members. They have the ability, as in this case, to change the balances of sick leave. They have the ability to change longevity. They have the ability to change personal days. They have the ability to change vacation days. That happens all the time as part of this collective bargaining process. If indeed the appellate division is correct in its determination that this requires the consent of the individual employees who would be adversely affected, I would submit to you that that would upend the entire collective bargaining process. There's no way that that could be accomplished. Under Title 34, the legislature is very clear about that. Under 34, 13A-5.3, what they say clearly and unequivocally, the majority representative has the right to represent the rights of its unit members. That cannot be questioned. We certainly could not question that, and we certainly could not question the individual employees who are affected by this. That would constitute an unfair labor practice.
In determining whether or not there's a vested right, is there an interpretive question involved in the way this language of the 2012 agreement is worded? Because it talks about payment in one category for 10 years of work, service, and at retirement, or for 25 years of service and leaving, and, you know, being separated from employment, and it gives a variety of reasons. So what is it? Is it the years of service and then the other event both having to come together, or is it just the one?
It is the latter, Justice LaVecchia. And I would respectfully submit that this is not a vested right, that this is a conditional right, mm-hmm. Which requires that certain events occur before there's an entitlement to that right.
Let me ask you a question then. I'm taking your answer as a given in this. Someone works longer than 10 years, chooses not to retire, hasn't quite reached 25 years of service, dies in active service. What do they get under the language of this?
Their estate would be entitled to the benefit that would accrue to them after 10 years.
So it would be considered a retirement?
It would not. It would mean that one of the conditions.
I'm testing your combination.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand the combination of events that you're saying has to take place in order for there to be something payable under this provision.
So there are one of three possibilities that can occur here. Either you can complete the 10 years of service.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can complete the 25 years of service and have an age service retirement,
right.
Or if death occurs before either of those events occur. I would take the position that actually death is not a condition that's satisfied for the benefit. Mm-hmm. It's one of those two benefits.
Well, doesn't it suggest that there's an interpretive question here that at least suggests there needs to be two things that have been put into the agreement to answer that question?
I would agree with that. And with regard to the death benefit, the death benefit is something that inures to your benefit if you have otherwise satisfied one of the other two requirements.
Right. So it undercuts the argument that this is a very clear vested right, equivalent to deferred compensation.
In my opinion, and based on my own research, I do not believe. I would respectfully submit to you, Justice LaVecchia, that this is not a vested right. It is a conditional right. And so then, drawing upon the legal analysis with regard to whether or not this was negotiable, there's a three-pronged test, and that three-pronged test has been applied to every issue dealing with negotiability. This intimately certainly affects the terms and conditions of employees. It is not preempted by statute or regulation, and it certainly is not a significant interference with governmental policy. So if we apply the Local 195 test to this, certainly it was negotiable. And if it is not a vested right, although I would respectfully submit to you that even if you would argue it was a vested right, the majority representative had the right under the statute to negotiate a reduction or a change in that right.
But do you agree? You said it's a conditional right, so I take it that means it's a conditional vested right. Do you agree that if it fits into that category, there has to be a clear and explicit waiver?
Justice Alvin,
in the successive contract.
I would take the position that it is a conditional right. And when the conditions are satisfied, that a right may vest. And with regard to whether there needs to be a clear and explicit waiver, I would submit to you that the contract language that is negotiated to change that right, or that inchoate right, or that conditional right, that the language that is negotiated must clearly indicate that there has been a change in that benefit. And that certainly happened here. And
okay, so you agree with the standard. You're saying that it's met in the 2015 agreement.
I am.
Can you give us other examples, analogous examples of what conditional rights in the sense that you say this is being the subject of negotiations and that and those rights being affected by a CNA?
Certainly, a conditional right would be your entitlement. Longevity, Justice Patterson. A conditional right would be your entitlement to be paid.
Longevity?
Longevity. Your entitlement to be paid for personal days. It would be your entitlement to be paid or to be compensated for any other monetary benefit that you relinquish. Those are all conditional rights.
Like, can you give me a little bit of an illustration of what you mean by that last one?
So when we talk about those benefits that you have in a contract that may be of some cash surrender value to you, those are conditional rights. So that would apply certainly to sick days. It would apply to personal days. It could apply to family illness days. Longevity is a conditional right. You have to satisfy certain requirements in terms of your terms of service in order to receive a longevity stipend. Those are the types of conditional rights that I'm referring to.
So that's the same. So a longevity stipend, 25 years, let's say, you get a stipend as at that point. Prior to that, there's no vested right into that, even at year 24.
That is correct, and I think I think Justice Patterson, you point up probably the most extreme example, and that is that if you get longevity at 25 years, and I'm at 24 years, and that contract is being negotiated, and the majority representative decides that they are going to negotiate a change in the longevity entitlement in order to achieve some other concession from the public employer, there's no question that in that extreme example, I wind up on the very short end of the stick. Me individually, if I'm that person with 24 years, but a decision is made as part of the collective bargaining process that the overall benefits to be achieved by the bargaining unit outweigh my individual expectation to that benefit.
Suppose you had a contract that sought to incentivize employees to remain on the job longer, and in the 2012 CNA it said, if you work for the entirety of this agreement, you'll get $1,000, but it won't be payable unless you work one additional year under the new CNA. Could the 2015 agreement delete that?
You made it a little more difficult for me, Chief Justice, because you've attached the successor agreement to that. It would be my opinion that if the majority representative decided to change that, because they extracted some benefit from the public employer, then I would answer that question in the affirmative, that it could be changed.
You have argued that your adversary's position, if adopted, would, and the appellate divisions, would upend the negotiation process. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, Justice Patterson, is that I think that what we are talking about here is a contractual expectation. I think employees to a collective negotiations agreement have certain expectations based on the contract, and they look at the contract every 3, 4, or 5 years, and they look forward to what their benefits may be. And if in fact those contractual expectations cannot be changed, and if individual employees can assert reliance and contractual expectations with regard to those benefits, then it is my opinion that this will upend the entire bargaining process.
Are you saying that districts will simply not negotiate terms, won't accept a concession on a term in this category and give a concession in a different category, like increase in salaries, because they would not rely on that concession from the employee's side actually coming in, actually taking place?
Well, that's precisely the problem. That is precisely the problem, because what it does is it doesn't ensure that there's going to be any stability in the bargaining process. And not only that, what it also does, and in this case really points that up, In this case, the majority representative, the union, extracted all of the promises they wanted from the public employer. They got a higher per diem payout on the payment for accumulated sick leave. They received a higher salary for the benefit of all employees. And then as a result, the employees who were dissatisfied with the settlement, disgruntled over the change in the sick leave balances, ultimately then sued the public employer for breach of contract. And I would emphasize here that they sued the public employer for breach of contract on a contract that had been on a contract that expired by its own terms, and that was succeeded by a new contract based on the exact language of the predecessor contract. So I think it will lead to a lack of stability in the bargaining process, and I think public employers are going to be very reticent with regard to contractual expectations. Taken to its extreme, if I register for my spring courses and my summer courses, and I'm looking forward to tuition reimbursement, and in the meantime, the majority representative negotiates the elimination of tuition or reduces the amount of tuition reimbursement, my contractual expectations have not been satisfied.
But is that a form of deferred compensation? I want to read to you just a line from Matter of Morris School, just
yes,
for you to comment on it. In a variety of factual settings, courts have held that a union has no authority on behalf of its membership to bargain away various forms of deferred compensation earned during the terms of prior collective bargaining agreements, absent knowing consent by those who would be adversely affected. Then it cites a federal district court case, and then it actually cites Illinois Appellate Division case. What do you have to say about that? And I raise that because you're saying that this, you know, whole structure of negotiation would be completely thrown out of whack if this were to be recognized. Go ahead.
So Justice Alvin, what I would say about that is that the last line that you read, and that is unless there has been a waiver or an agreement to change those benefits, the issue in Morris Township was that a fact finder unilaterally changed the level of benefits that would affect employees. As with every single case that has been cited to this court, without exception, it was all unilateral action on the part of a public employer or a private employer upon the expiration of a collective bargaining agreement. What makes this case very different, and I think goes to the essence of what you read from that decision, Justice Alvin, is that this was done by the majority representative through an arm's-length collective negotiations process and pursuant to the statute, which I would respectfully submit, preempts individual consent. That individual consent is given by the employees to the majority representative when they are elected. And so what makes this very different from the Morris Township case and from every other case that has been cited to the court is that that here the parties agreed to this.
You've cited for us examples of conditional rights that you've argued can be subject to renegotiation by a majority of the represented unit. Can you give us examples that would not?
Certainly. Statutory rights. Those are vested rights. They are not subject to negotiation. So, for example, and I hate to harken back to the last case, but tenure rights certainly are not going to be subject to negotiation. Seniority rights are not going to be subject to negotiation because all of those rights are vested rights pursuant to some statutory entitlement. Pension rights are not going to be subject to negotiation because those, too, are vested rights.
Outside of the statutory arena?
Yes.
Are there others?
Outside of the statutory arena.
Are there examples that you could point to? I'm not trying to test you. I'm looking for your assistance.
Of course. So outside of the statutory arena, I'm trying to conjure up an example of a vested right that would not be statutory. And I could imagine a situation in which there was a contractual vested right between the time that a contract expired and the time that a new contract was negotiated.
Doesn't the state trooper case support that scenario?
It does, Justice LaVecchia. That would be potentially a non-statutory vested right.
So the prior hypo that I gave you without the additional piece that you had to work one extra year?
Yes. So it is the board's position here that the appellate division's decision to essentially ignore the collective bargaining agreement, to reach a determination based on the case law that it cited and which has all been submitted to you based on unilateral employer action, resulted in a vested right. And because it was a vested right, the appellate division determined that the parties could not legally reach an agreement that interfered with that right. And I would respectfully submit to you that that is incorrect, and that this decision, if it stands, will be interpreted as applying to any number of variable conditions. It will change the stability of labor negotiations.
If this contract were deemed to be ambiguous on the subject, all it would do is require future contracts of this type to be much more explicit. And that wouldn't be doing violence to collective negotiations, would it?
Justice Alvin, I would submit to you that if it was determined that this contract language was ambiguous on its face, then we would look to extrinsic evidence. And if we look to extrinsic evidence, we look to the transcript of the deposition of the union president, who said that this clearly was something that was discussed, it was debated, that she had representation from the New Jersey Education Association, that they discussed whether it should be done retroactively or prospectively, that they understood the consequences of it, and that they agreed to it because of the concessions that they extracted from the public employer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bryce.
If it may please the court, good afternoon. Robert Greitz on behalf of the New Jersey School Board Association. And I always joke that sometimes being amicus, the good thing is whoever goes first usually makes most of your points. So that's the very good point about this. I'm going to be as brief as I can be. A couple of things here. What seems to be getting lost is this is not a statutory right that the board has tried to do away with. This is a contractual obligation. It's a contractual obligation. The only thing that's statutory in all of this is that employees have the right, school employees under Title 18A, have the right to accrue their sick leave unencumbered from 10 days to 300 days to 350 days. There's no legal requirement anywhere that they be paid for them. That's purely a subject of negotiations. Some contracts pay at $50 a day. Some contracts pay at the per diem rate. Some contracts don't pay at all for any accumulated sick leave. When you retire, you retire with whatever days you had. You don't take them with you. You retire and they go away.
Your adversary's point is, one of their points, is that for employees who were between that 15,000 and 25,000 level during the 2012 agreement, the 2012 agreement told them that the accrual of time of sick days during that time would provide for additional compensation.
That is accurate.
And they say now the 2015 agreement is telling them, you know what, that wasn't the case. That this is a unique, they haven't said unique, but this is an unusual circumstance for that reason. What's your response to that?
And I don't want to say, and I've accused of sounding cavalier in their brief, it was what the parties negotiated. The four employees' majority representative, who represents all of the employees within that collective bargaining unit, whether they want to be in the unit or not, they represent everybody. They negotiated with the board for this change in the contract language. They, as a member of the collective bargaining unit, they have essentially the majority representative negotiates on their behalf of all of the items within that contract. They cannot negotiate away statutory rights, but they can clearly negotiate away anything or make any changes to within that contract. For example, vacation leave. I'll use vacation leave as an example. If a contract says that 15 years you get 20 days, at 20 years you get 25 days, and 30 years you get 30 days, I'm just completely making up those numbers. If the parties get together and they change it and say vacation leave, no longer 30 days, you're only going to get 26 days.
So your analogy there is, if that change were made and that were effective, then some of those intervening years in which the employee was working thinking that every X number of days is worth an additional vacation day was devalued after the fact.
Correct.
And that's okay.
That is okay. Now, I'll take aside any arguments here with respect to tenure rights and the reduction of their salary, because there may be another argument there, which I don't believe we do not need to get into. But with respect to, you just use your custodial or, you know, a non-tenured custodian, you could reduce their days of vacation down at any time through negotiations. That's the negotiations process. The parties agree upon that.
So that even if you take the analogy further, even in a three-year period when a CNA applied, the employee may have viewed every X number of days to be worth another vacation day, but after the fact, it could be worth less.
It absolutely could be reduced based upon that. Yes. And again, as cited in our brief, I do believe that the original plaintiff and the amicus NJEA overread the Morris County case. And I know there's been much made about the Morris County case, but the Morris County case, as Mr. Fogarty rightly pointed out, addressed a decision by a fact finder and a PERC rule. There's been no decision by any court in the state of New Jersey that says vested unused accumulated sick leave is a vested right and you can't reduce their compensation. There's been no decision anywhere on that. And there's been a belief that the Morris County case stands for that.
It stands for what you say, but it has some generally broad language, like deferred compensation generally survives expiration of the terms of the agreement. You wouldn't disagree with that, would you?
Deferred compensation in the sense of my regular salary, I'm going to defer $50,000 of it.
Well, no, take this case. Generally, now your argument is the successor agreement is one of those exceptions, I suppose, right?
Yes. I would also submit that this is not deferred compensation. This is accumulated sick leave that you're only entitled to take when you're sick. This is not an argument where I'm going to keep accruing my days just because I'll get a big payout at the end. You can only use your sick days when you're sick under Title 18A. Now, I do live in the real world, and I do know employees occasionally use their sick days for times when they're not sick.
One thing Morris does say is that sick days is deferred compensation. Are you disagreeing with that?
I would submit that that is an overread of what unused sick leave is. Based upon the fact that it's specifically entitled only for when you're sick, there's no right to being paid out for it.
I thought the whole purpose of compensating people for sick leave upon retirement is to encourage them not to use their sick leave. They comment even when they're feeling under the weather. Isn't that the whole purpose or no?
The purpose behind paying them for when they leave is multifaceted in many districts. There may be some districts where, in fact, they do want to encourage their employees to come to work. There are some other districts where they might simply say wrongfully so, I would submit, but they would say it's a length of service. You've been here for 20 years.
I think it's a 2015 contract. Isn't there a provision that says you're going to get an extra, $1,000 if you don't miss a single day of work?
I believe it is the 2015 contract.
Okay. I mean, so there are different inducements to encourage teachers to, come in, and even when they're not feeling great, and when perhaps they can use their sick day to work, correct?
I would submit there are in contracts, yes.
What is your view of the argument being made by your colleague over here and of the impact on the negotiation process going forward?
I concur with Mr. Fogarty on that argument. I can envision many situations where negotiating with a union, that the union comes forward with a proposal, the board's trying to, would like to reduce its costs, and is sitting there saying, we don't know if we're going to get a challenge to this by some of your members going forward, so we're going to hold off on, making any concessions to reach an agreement. And one thing to keep in mind in this case is, I'm going to strike that and leave it. Don't make a statement you don't, you're 100% sure of the answer, so I wasn't going to make that statement.
Can we come back to the question that Justice Albin asked you about that accumulation if no sick leave is used during the particular day? Is that the payment of $1,000 or $1,200, is that paid when someone retires or leaves service, or is that paid during that particular school year?
I'm going to have to defer to Mr. Fogarty with respect to that, with respect to the very, that particular provision, but I believe it would, I believe, and they will correct me if I'm wrong, it's paid during the year. It's $1,000.
It's in a separate part of the language of the agreement than the accumulation, talking about what is given to someone at the end of 10 years or 25 years, respectively. So I asked the question, but I want to, because I'm not sure of the answer, it seems suggestive of what we're talking about.
I'm unsure.
It's paid in the school year.
We'll get that later from Mr. Fogarty.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Friedman.
May it please the court, Chief Justice. I've reserved my 5 minutes, so I'm going to take that with the court's forbearance.
Of course.
I just want to point out preliminarily before I forget.
Try to keep your voice up a little.
I'm sorry.
If you can.
Pardon? Sure. I want to point out that the plaintiffs all objected to this and voted against this provision in the contract, just in case there's any question about that. But what we're asking the court today is to announce a rule unequivocally that deferred compensation, which has been earned to be paid at a later date, cannot be taken away or reduced by a school board, either by itself or in combination with negotiations. Whether you say it, whether it's been said expressly, can you hear me? Expressly or impliedly, the courts in New Jersey have recognized, including in the context of sick leave, for 50 or 60 years, that these benefits that are earned during a contract to be paid later can't be taken away and shouldn't be taken away. That's consistent, by the way, with the law in other states, the Illinois case that one of the justices referred to, the Lawrence case. There's a New Hampshire case, a Gilman case that say the same thing. And there's numerous federal cases, which I will mention, that say the same thing. By the way, it's also consistent with the approach of the New Jersey legislature. For example, if you look at NJSA 18A30.3.6, which imposed a cap on unused sick leave, the legislature was very careful not to impose, not to limit sick leave had been acquired, which had been acquired before the date that law took effect. And as a matter of fact, they made clear that it would not even apply to contracts which were in effect before and spanned and went beyond the date that the law took effect. And that's really the approach that this court took, I think, in Schindler. I believe in Schindler, and we talk about when it's vesting. In the Schindler case, the cap could not be applied to people retroactively, and I believe the court said that what had happened was permissible because it didn't infringe on that previously acquired right. And the same thing was in Caponegro. So if we talk about was it vested and when did it vest, in Caponegro, I think the formula was 3 days equal 1 day's pay. And the employer had to observe that, could change it prospectively, but not retroactively. In Schindler, there was a similar effect where the cap of 15, same cap, I might have this backwards in two cases, but the cap of $15,000 could not be applied to previously acquired sick leave.
And that, that was a statutory cap?
Pardon?
Statutory cap.
You know, I'm not sure. It was a regulatory or a statutory cap. Yes, it was. And it's only fair because, after all, the person who doesn't take the sick leave is the person who earned the benefit. And I don't think our cases allow that the benefit that that person earned to be given to another person or to be given back to the board. And the fact that it's negotiated, besides the fact there are cases which say you can't negotiate, this can't be negotiated, really doesn't make a difference, because when a school board acts, it doesn't have unlimited authority. When a school board acts by negotiations, at the end of the day, it's exercising the power it has to pass policies into pass compensation. And if it doesn't have the authority in the first place, just like the district didn't have the authority in Caponegro, it didn't have the authority in Schindler, it doesn't have the authority to do it through negotiations any more than if it did it unilaterally. But that's a whole other story, because it doesn't have the authority to do it in negotiations under the case law that we cited. Our position is that the Morris case got it right. Even though the Morris case might have miscited a little bit about PERC, the Morris case went into detail. It's consistent with what our law is. It's consistent with the law in other jurisdictions, cite many cases. It's well-reasoned, so it's not a situation where they just said, we're going to rubber stamp PERC. They went to great pains to explain what they were doing. If you get to the question of when it vests, I would submit it clearly vests at minimum maximum. It certainly vests after 10 years, just like in Schindler, Schindler and Caponegro. Nobody retired, but they were entitled to the benefit of what they had earned. In the one case, 3 days for one day. In the other case, not to have the cap. And it's not the same as longevity, because in longevity, even though it's based on how many years you've been there, it's what your salary is going to be for that period of time. And there's no right to have longevity in every single contract. This contract, by definition, there's no way anybody could satisfy this within one contract. Nobody could work 10 years in a 3-year contract. In order to acquire this benefit, it's over a series of contracts. So it's not on the same par as longevity. I think what the board confuses is, what does the contract mean? What the contract meant now, whatever the parties intended, is irrelevant. What really matters is what they intended when these benefits were conferred, when the service was rendered, because that's when it vests. And no New Jersey case has ever allowed anything like this to happen. For example, the Botany Mills case, the Owens case, in those cases, they say when the service was rendered, you acquired this benefit. The other states which have grappled, and it's basically the same approach as the courts have taken in Schindler and Caponegro. In the other states which have dealt with it, the Lawrence case, the Caponegro case, and there is no threat to negotiations. With all due respect, if this was an uncertain point, but the cases are very clear that vested rights can't be taken away, and they're very clear how to treat accumulated sick leave. So if we can go into other hypotheticals that might cause confusion, there may be some, but this isn't one of them.
Well, let me ask a hypo and tell me if it confuses things. Suppose you have $16,000 in compensable time at the end of the 2012 CNA. Is that a vested right?
For the $16,000, yes.
And what if in the following year under the next CNA you fall ill and use up several thousand dollars worth of sick leave time? Do you still have a vested right? The question is, when does it vest, this particular type of right?
It vests when you get to the 10 years. Now, if you use the time up, you may not have the time to get paid, and you might not have the time to get paid. So at that point, the cap may be irrelevant because you're no longer in cap territory.
You heard the series of questions I asked.
You know, yes.
Typically, our court attempts to avoid broad pronouncements when they're not necessary. So my question to you is there ambiguity in the 2015 CNA, Collective Negotiation Agreement, concerning whether or not the sick pay that you're, let's say it's conditionally vested, was intended to be recognized into the next schedule?
Well, we to be candid, we sort of argued the case as if that's what the parties thought they were doing.
Would you mind just keeping your voice up?
Oh, sure. To be candid, we kind of argued the case as if the parties kind of thought that that's what they were doing, but they're not allowed to do it. But on the other hand, the contracts are very clear that what you earn during the contract can't be taken away. So I think you would have to read those two things together.
So my question to you is, is it your position that the 2015 contract intended not to permit the carryover of the greater than 15,000, or did it mean to extinguish it, or is it unclear?
I think it is unclear, because it has to be clear, unequivocal. I thought that's what they meant to do, but it has to be a clear, unequivocal waiver.
If that's the case, why would we need to go any further? Like, why would we have to reach the issue of whether or not the deferred compensation / vested right sick pay can never be taken away in a successive contract?
Then you would.
If it's not clear in this particular one, we need go no further than say, it's not a clear and explicit waiver.
That's correct. The other thing I want to just talk about, the confusion is, and we cite the Elgin case, which I think very clear, U.S. Supreme Court case, which very clearly says that once a contract is negotiated, it's done. And you can't go back and renegotiate or take things away that are in the prior contract. You can grieve over things, but you can't negotiate over those things. If you accept the board's position that you can go back and negotiate over these benefits, well, the other side of the coin is we can go back and negotiate over more things that we want from prior agreements, or the union can go back.
Well, look, the parties can make a contract as explicit or hazy as they want. For instance, the 2012 one could have specifically said that this the sick pay that's accumulated has to be used during the period of this contract, period, and will not carry over into another contract. That could be done. That would be very simple. We would be before this court.
There's no case that says in order for a right to be vested or deferred or preserved, you have to spell out in the contract that it's vested or preserved. None of the cases that this court has dealt with, like state troopers and the other cases where they've said when people took actions in reliance upon what the policy was, said the policy had to say the policy could never be changed.
But do you agree that the contract could say, that you would be able to draft a contract that would say during the period of this contract, the accumulated sick pay has to be used it has to be paid during this period. You have to retire during this period, 10 years, 25, or otherwise it will not carry over into a new contract. You could say that, correct?
We could do that right now.
Excuse me?
We could do that now, but sure, we could do that right now.
I'm giving you that hypothetical because that would suggest that the right isn't the sort of immutable vested right that you may be suggesting.
Yes, if you wanted to make it non-immutable, and in fact, I think ERISA does that very simply, you could draft a contract that says this is good, use the days now, or this can be extinguished.
But isn't that the opposite of what you argue in your brief? And I'm just reading your point heading. The Appellate Division properly applied well-settled law to find that payment for accrued sick leave already earned constitutes a vested right subject to divestiture through negotiations only with express consent of the affected parties. If that's true, if that's your argument, then the hypothetical that Justice Albin just brought up, where the contract says use it or lose it, in the next, you could lose it at the end of this contract, you will lose it at the end of this contract term, would have to be approved by the individual affected parties.
Yeah, that's what Morris says. And in fact, one of the federal cases, Borkunowitz, I don't know if I said that exactly right, that says the same thing. It's a Third Circuit case on disability leave, and two of the judges said, well, this was a vested right, they met the condition, you can't take it away. And there was an opinion by Judge Cowan, which said, well, I concur, but the reason I concur is exactly the reason that the appellate division did.
And then
the individual has to waive it.
And you've argued that, but that would mean that the answer to Justice Albin's question is no, you could not make that contractual provision, because that would have the same effect, which is, you get to the end of the term, and you had the money the day before the term of the contract was over, but you don't have it after. That would be, according to you, the divestiture of a vested right, which can only be accomplished with individual consent.
Yes, you could say you take it or you lose it. You could easily draft that language and include that language.
Which means that the rights we're talking about are contractually created by the parties, correct? So they're not coming from, like, the netherworld. These rights are what you determine them to be.
That's correct. I don't know if that's a question.
That goes back to me, to the question of, like, what did you intend in 2012 and what did you intend in 2015?
Well, again, as I said before, I certainly in 2012, there's no indication that it wouldn't vest and it could be taken away. 2015 is not as clear. But following up on what we said about the individual, certainly can conclude that in the absence of a knowing, clear, decisive type of waiver, even if I thought they were waiving or they thought they were waiving it, it's not clear enough, and the case gets decided on that ground.
But we should look at the contract with objective eyes. How would an objectively reasonable person interpret the language? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. And again, though, I would stress, as Morris said, that even if an objectively reasonable person would say we intended to take it away from you, it doesn't matter because you can't negotiate the past and you can't do it without, you can't take away vested right, and you certainly can't do it without the individual's consent. But I don't think anybody's argued that the 2012-15 contract has anything that suggests that this is invested and this could be taken away. And in fact, it would be kind of unreasonable in the face of 50 or 60 years of New Jersey cases, not to mention federal cases and other state cases, which have all treated this as rights that accrue when you forego that sick leave.
Mr. Friedman, exactly what is the right that is vested? Is it the right to payment upon retirement with the right number of years? Or is it the right to payment for any sick days that accrued during a 2012 agreement, regardless of whether they're used during that time period?
The value of the sick leave that you have not taken up until the time that the policy changed. So all the days not taken, just like in the
Shumway. So the other conditions don't even matter. As long as the other conditions don't even matter if they have not come to fruition yet.
25 years?
Yes.
No, the other conditions you have, I'm not even sure you have to get to the 10 years, but certainly once you get to the 10 years, you qualify. And at that point,
but they have nothing to do with the vesting. They have nothing to do with the vesting.
The vesting would be at least at the 10 years, or at worst at the 10 years.
Well, I'm asking you if you have to reach at least 10 years to vest anything.
Yes. Yes, you have to reach 10 years, and then anything up until the date the contract changed, you are protected, and the sick leave is worth what the sick leave was until the contract changed.
But my question, okay, now is combining the two. Must you use the time that you've accumulated and wish to be paid for at the time of retirement during the time of this contract period?
I'm not sure I follow you when you say must you use them, because you only get paid if you don't use them.
Well, must you leave employment upon retirement during the 3 years of the contract in order to take the benefit of this vested right?
But the days are worth what they were worth before until 2017, and then the formula changes.
Why is that different from the vacation pay analogy? Because your adversary talked about vacation pay. Just hypothetically, you get 10 days per year, and then it becomes you get 8 days per year, and that's contractually agreed to. So I'm working, and I think I'm getting 10 days per year in the job I'm doing, and I find out that the next CNA is going to only give me 8 days. The value of my, if this is something important to me, the value of my per day accrual of vacation days has just been diminished, and my union representative has agreed to that, and nobody called me up and said,
well, that's
you're
a little more complicated, because I don't know whether I had to take those 10 days during that previous year or the 10 days carried over.
Either way. Let's say they either carried over or they didn't. The fact is that I'm earning vacation days by working 10 days.
Let's say I earned the days at the value that those days were when I would have taken those days if I'm allowed to carry the days over. And in fact, I think it's the either the Owens or the Botany Mills case says that's a vested right to be paid, that in that case is paid when I leave.
Okay, so
let me just finish. So it doesn't disappear just because the contract expires. I still have that right, even when there's no contract.
But your adversaries argue that there is no loss here, because what they did in the new contract was take the difference and apply that to additional benefits to the teachers in the form of increased compensation and otherwise. How do you respond to that?
I don't think they have the right to take away what person A earned and give it to person B for some other reason, which is what you're really saying. Any more than the board could say, well, you know what, if there was no collective bargaining agreement, we think we could do something better with this money than what we're doing with it, so your benefit, what you earned, is gone.
So under your analysis then, when someone reaches the time that they're leaving service for whatever reason, with the requisite number of years of time in the school district, the employer has to go back and figure out when each sick day for which the person is being paid out was earned and what the value was under that particular contract period?
Well, yes, but there's no mystery in this case, because we know exactly what these...
I just want to understand the full reach of the holding that you're asking this court to give.
I'm saying that what I'm asking the court to say is that whatever I earned under the prior contract at that value, absent something clear in that contract to say I'm not really earning it and it can be changed, I'm entitled to be paid at that.
So we're going to have to keep track of each individual unused sick leave day and figure out which one was saved and from what contract.
If we don't keep track of how much sick leave people have, we're not doing our job.
That would be true even if it were $15,000 under the 2015. So, I mean, if someone retired within the first couple of days of that contract, assuming that the school board is correct, you'd still have to go back under the former contracts and add it all up, correct?
Even if they didn't get paid for it, you should know, we should have a record of how many sick days people took every year, and we should know what the salary was that year.
Is the analysis any different if you're talking about sick leave, which a person may well need as they continue their employment? And if they earn back above the $15,000 threshold after that, they're doing it under a new CNA with a different set of expectations.
Well, if somebody takes sick leave and some now falls below whatever number, whatever that maximum is, they're going to get paid less than the maximum.
Yes,
but was it best? I'm sorry.
But you've argued that it's vested even if they fall below, because if
threshold. Regardless of what the district does, if the district now is trying to diminish the value of the sick leave. But if the person uses the sick leave so they only have so many days left, they may not have that $25,000 anymore.
Different question. They may earn it back by staying on for additional years.
Oh.
And you're saying if they earn it back, notwithstanding the fact that the contract under which they've earned it back has a different set of expectations because the numbers are different, they're still vested.
They're vested in what they took before it changed. Once the contract changed, the days have a different value.
You may have just answered that question.
Sure.
But I'm not sure. I'm a little slower than the rest of us up here. You've worked 10 years. Under the 2012 contract, you've got $20,000 unused sick leave. You have a rough couple years after that, and you drop down below the 20. Frankly, you drop down below the 15, and you decide to retire. Do you still get the 20?
No, now you've lost those sick days, so you don't have enough sick days.
So how have you vested?
The 20.
So how is it vested? A vested is a right that you've earned that can't be taken away. The cap is $25,000. How is that $25,000 or $20,000 vested if you can lose it?
Well, you could say that about any payment for accumulated sick leave.
Maybe.
I suppose that payment for accumulated sick leave isn't really worth anything. Then it's
No, it's worth something. You're going to get paid for the amount of sick leave you didn't use.
The deal is that if you don't use the sick leave, you're going to get paid for it. So if you're saying if you use the sick leave, you don't get anything, that's the flip side of the deal. That's part of it.
And what was vested then?
Pardon?
What was your vested right?
Your vested was that if you didn't take the leave, you would get paid for it.
So why is it vested before we even know how the world is going to turn out for this individual? I mean, how can the right be vested at a point where there could be, as it turns out, unfortunate health considerations or something else causes that person to not have the right to any payment for sick leave?
Well, again, it's a trade-off. If you don't use it, you have a right to it, and that right can't be taken away. You understand that if you use it, it's not going to have that same value at that
point. It's vested unless you give it away. What you're saying is if you carry over into the next contract $20,000 and you use $6,000 of it up, then your cap is going to be $15,000 in the next contract, correct?
Correct, and you may not even meet the cap, right? You used the time.
I thought you gave a different answer earlier, that if you earn that back under the new contract, you still get the benefit of the higher cap.
The days that you earn after the new contract are no longer governed by the old cap. It's governed by the new cap.
So the vested right is the right to receive those sick days at that rate up to the 2015 contract as of that day. It's your right to use those sick days at that rate up to the new contract is vested.
Correct. And if you use those days up then
later on, you've lost that amount, but your right to use those days that you have up to the new contract at that 2012 rate for as much as they let you get, up to 25,000. At that rate, under the 2012 contract.
Yes, and you took those days on that condition, subject to that condition, and you can't undo that, and you can't turn the clock back.
The dollars are not vested. Rights are vested.
Pardon?
The right's not vested. The right is vested.
The right to those dollars is vested unless you use it.
But the dollars are not.
Yes, and that's the condition that I took to sick leave, and that's the condition that was offered, and I can't go back and undo that.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think I covered it. I think the Perkunowitz case is the case which controls, and, you know, we could debate it all, but if you look at our own cases, Caponegro, Shunler, and all the cases have dealt with this, other states, Gilman, Lawrence, they've all viewed it the same. They've all viewed it as a vested right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cohen?
May it please the court. Let's take a look at this for a second, shall we, through the eyes of an employee. One thing that none of the distinguished lawyers before you have mentioned is that this language was in this contract, this type of language in the 2012 contract I'm referring to, for 20 years. 20 years you're going along. Let's not forget that in education law for many years, until very recently, you couldn't have more than a three-year contract, a three-year collective bargaining agreement. Very recently, a five-year. So now you have seen this language in this contract over the entirety of your career, and now what the management bar is saying is that they can pull the rug out from under you, that a majority rep can do that with the employer. I say absolutely not. You cannot take away that type of unique vested right that was a creature of this contract over those many years, absent a knowing and intelligent waiver by the individuals who stood to lose that benefit. Now, I will tell you, as a practical matter,
would that be everyone employed at that time that was part of that contract? Every teacher?
What's that? I'm sorry.
Would that be every teacher that was under employment during that contract? All of them.
Who met
every single one.
Who met those conditions? Yes. Now, as a practical matter, I will tell you that this case is an outlier. It really is. The sky is not falling. I bargain all types of public employees, police, fire, etc. You know what we do when we have an issue like this? We tier it. We say the people who have vacation, you know, over all these years and have an expectation of a certain thing, they're going to be in tier one. Those employees who are new, they are going to be in this new tier, so that over time, the people who are eligible for this vested right, you know, they phase out. And if you bargain something, the new people...
They didn't do that here.
What's that?
They didn't do that here.
That's my point, that this is an outlier.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, but they didn't do that here. So aren't you really arguing that the parties understood the practice for 20 years, the teachers that were part of that contract understood the practice for 20 years, and the intent in entering into this contract was what you're arguing they should get?
My point is that you, in this very small circumstance, with very few people involved here, they needed to get a waiver from those folks if they were going to make that change to that term and condition of employment.
Did that? You've looked at the 2015 contract, have you?
I have.
Is it clear?
It's not clear.
Okay. So if it's not clear and explicit, why do we have to... And let's say that's a winning point, hypothetically. Why would we have to go any further?
You wouldn't. I don't think you would. Couple of other...
Okay, tell us why you don't think it's clear and explicit.
I don't think it's clear and explicit because, first of all, it doesn't say specifically that those people who were vested are not going to be covered. You've got the savings clause that you referred to earlier in the argument. It's at best ambiguous. And furthermore, you know at that point in time that you're agreeing to the 2015 contract that you already have this new statute which tiers this benefit. How could you leave it hanging like that? I don't see how you could, knowing that you now have a statute that in effect is what we do all the time when we bargain contracts and we tier things. So in the face of that, to then say, well, we're not going to address it in the contract, then I think it's ambiguous.
But if it's ambiguous, we don't answer the question of what it means. Don't we have to go back and find out what exactly did the parties intend and believe at the time they negotiated this 2015?
No, because the real issue is, can a majority representative waive a benefit that's been vested for all this period of time?
You're assuming
so ambiguity doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter because a majority rep can't do that. Let me give you an example.
If we didn't reach that, your position is, I'm trying to understand, if it's a condition, if it were a conditionally vested right, the 2015 contract would have to be in a clear and explicit waiver, which it is not.
Correct. Okay. Now, to follow up on that, Chief Justice Ravner, you asked Mr. Fogarty for an example of a contractual right that, you know, would be vested. In Wright versus East Orange, this court said that you could negotiate contractual tenure for employees who don't get statutory tenure. All right, let's take the same scenario. Somebody gets contractual tenure, custodian, who doesn't get statutory tenure, or an aide, or some other school district employee who doesn't get tenure under the teacher tenure statute, the secretarial tenure statute, or the clerical statute. And they get tenure under, let's say, a contract in the 1990s or 2000. Could the majority representative and the board agree to a new contract where they get stripped of their contractual tenure without getting their consent? I think not.
I don't think that your adversaries are suggesting that tenure is in the same category.
But we're talking now about contractual tenure. That's a creature of the contract that this court in Wright versus East Orange said you could negotiate contractual tenure for individuals who don't get statutory tenure. So now it's just a creature of the contract. It has nothing to do with the statute. You think you could say to somebody, oh, I know you've had tenure for the last 15 years, but now you don't have it? No. And that's an example, to me, of a vested right. There are very, very few under the bargaining law. There are very, very few that you could have. And
very few what?
Very few contractual provisions that would amount to a vested right. If you go to the New Jersey Public Employee Reporter and you go to section 43, which is the section...
Isn't that a contractual provision here, sir? The sick pay?
What's that?
Isn't that a contractual provision?
It is. But it is...
A few under your interpretation that are vested right?
It's vested because it's not something you can accrue in one contract. You have to go through multiple contracts. That's my point. You would have to go through multiple contracts to get this benefit. Even under school law, if you take the minimum period in the contract, the new 2015 contract, 10 years, you still have to go through at least Under the new law, you'd have to go through at least two contracts, and under the old law, you'd have to go through at least three.
Mr. Cohen, your argument, I think, admits that there's two parts to this vested right that you're arguing for. One, that you have to have the requisite length of service, and two, you have to have the point in time in which it would be payable, mm-hmm. correct? So you either have to have 10 years and retire. If you are separated from service before retirement, you don't get the payment, correct?
Well, unless you get 25.
Okay, right, if you have 25. What about the hypothetical that I asked before? Suppose someone works past the 10 years, doesn't retire, stays in active service because they want to build more time, but doesn't stay in service to hit the 25, leave for any point in time, but dies in active service. What does someone get under this vested right that you're arguing for?
I think that would depend on another factor, which is what has been the practice in the district, because it would be unique to that district.
So now you are arguing past practice, but the point is you're looking to a contractual understanding of what someone gets that combines two events, the service and the triggering event that allows for payment.
For more than 20 years and more than...
Or less than 20.
What?
Or less
than... No, I'm saying 20 years of history of collective negotiated agreements that said the very same thing.
Okay.
The very same thing.
The point of my question, though,
year after year.
You're making an argument off of labor law for past practice to get to a contractual answer, right?
That's right.
Okay.
On the issue of the deceased employee.
Which suggests that there has to be a contractual meeting of the minds and eligibility in order to get this vested right that you're claiming under this provision.
I would believe that you would there would be an argument made that somebody who met all the criteria.
And a criteria is a triggering event.
That's the triggering event. Would be eligible whether they were alive or deceased. I do believe that. But again, I want to just say that I think that the sky would not be falling. You're not upending collective negotiations in this case. Not at all. There are very, very, very few subjects of bargaining that could even qualify for a vested benefit, right? You can't bargain, even pensions, you can't bargain, right? Because the PERC statute says in Section 8.1, you can't amend or annul a pension statute. And this court has said 40 years ago in Fairlawn, you can't tinker with a retirement, like I think the case was about could parties bargain an early retirement incentive, and you said no, you can't. It could because it would skew the actuarial fund, right? So, but outside of that, there are very few. Potentially the sick leave, the accumulated vacation.
So you would put accumulated vacation in the same category.
Depending on the circumstances, but I mean you have case law in this state from this court going back to 1956, right? Talking about the Owens Press Publishing Company case, talking about the severance pay and the fact that these are things that accrue over time. There's very few negotiable things that accrue over time
is severance pay a vested right? The right to severance pay?
Could be in a certain circumstance. It could be. It could be.
It's vested before severance?
In other words, if you met the conditions of that contract under your case law, you would say that it's vested. You'd have to have that. There would have to be a legitimate expectation on the part of the employee. And in this case, it's a no-brainer to me.
Right. But in that case, Mr. Cohen, and it fits with your answer to me, the court upheld the payment of severance pay post-contract term, but there had been no subsequent agreement that would have shed light on the party's new meeting of the mind.
That's right.
Okay.
If the contract is ambiguous, do we look to extrinsic evidence?
I think that what you would look to here in the unique area of labor relations, either in the public sector or the private sector, you would look to the history of either the collective bargaining in the private sector or in collective negotiations in the public sector.
I think the plaintiff's argument is that we would look to the party's intent at the time of the agreement under contract law.
Right, but sometimes...
Let's pause there. If we have evidence of the party's respective understanding of what they were doing, is that relevant?
Yes, but we're talking about, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7 contracts ago, and it may not be that. What we do know historically is that the same language, and it stipulated what was meant by it, was carried forth contract after contract after contract.
My question wasn't precise enough. I'm talking about the 2015 agreement. If we find that to be ambiguous, and talking about the questions Justice Alvin's been asking, would we look to extrinsic evidence of the party's intent?
Well, but see, but here...
We'll get to the next point, but is there a yes or no on that?
Difficulty because you're talking here about as if I understand your question correctly, the majority rep and the employer could forget about what's going on with these individuals who had this expectation of getting it, that they could...
I'm not getting to the issue of whether or not there's authority. I'm talking about if there is a normal provisions of a contract, if there's a finding of ambiguity, you then looked to extrinsic evidence of the party's intent as one of the next things you
normally
do.
You would, but in the case of a vested benefit, you have to take into consideration the expectation of employees, and usually a very small group of employees, who have waited for this day when they retire that they're going to get this benefit.
That's the question. What is vested? That's the question that we are grappling with. I know what your answer to that question is, Mr. Cohen.
All you have to do is look at these people who are the plaintiffs.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I mean, you have one person who is, I think, eligible for $18,000 and change, and the rest were eligible for $25,000. Why shouldn't they get that when they've waited all those years? Who are the employer and the majority rep to all of a sudden say, you're not getting that, and we're refusing to tier it, we're not going to tier it, or we're not going to ask you for a waiver. How could that be?
I don't think you answered Justice Patterson's question, so I actually want to explore that a little bit further.
Okay.
So let's say you could look at extrinsic evidence to find out what the meeting of the minds were between the representative of the union and the representative of the district. And that would suggest the meeting of the minds that it was intended for the next contract not to have a retroactive provision. But the language of the contract itself is not clear and explicit waiver.
Correct.
Wouldn't that govern, because people are voting on a contract based on the language, not upon the discussions that the representatives may be having among themselves. And wouldn't that be seemingly the analysis that you would do with I'll call it conditional vested right?
100%.
You're saying people didn't understand it, but yet the plaintiffs all very, very firmly objected to it, absolutely seemed to understand it, and voted against it.
Well, that's right. But what I'm saying is that there are very, very few terms and conditions of employment that are not subject to that kind of vote. This is one of them.
Why did the Education Association have a bargaining session about it if, as a matter of law, this should never have been the discussion of bargaining?
The parties didn't raise it. It's just, look, you could say, why, you know, at the time that this was being litigated, why didn't the board implead the association? Would it have made any difference, really? What they did was wrong. Whether it was well-intentioned or not, it was wrong. You can't, a majority representative, in my entire experience of going on 43 years, I don't know, I can't even point to another circumstance like this where the board and the majority rep said, we're going to cut out the individuals who have been waiting all this time to get this deferred compensation.
Is that clear on this record that that's the agreement that they came to?
It's, Mr. Fogarty points to the association president, but I don't know that there's no testimony here about what happened in the bargaining. We don't know what happened in the bargaining. We only know, and would it really matter? Because parties.
The reason I'm asking that question is because you're saying that they came to this agreement to cut them out, and I'm asking you, is there anything in the record to suggest
I misspoke on that. But what I would say is, we don't know what happened in the bargaining. We don't know what happened in the bargaining. There's no evidence about what did happen in the bargaining.
Can I just clarify one thing? Because you agree with Mr. Friedman that this right vested at 10 years, period.
Yeah.
Okay. They argue this right vests when we retire. That's the basis of the disputed legal argument, correct?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that, it says 10 years and you must retire.
Yeah, but if you require retirement, you lose.
If you what?
If it requires retirement to vest, you lose for anybody who didn't retire.
I don't know that that's true.
Never mind.
I don't know that that's true.
Never mind. Go ahead. Continue. Okay.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Fogarty, rebuttal? And at some point in your rebuttal, if you could address Mr. Cohen's argument about the contractually vested right and whether that can be undone.
So I'd like to address Justice Lavecchia's question first, and that is with regard to the stipend that is payable to teachers based on their accumulated sick days, more importantly, the fact that they don't utilize sick and personal days. Mm-hmm. That's an annual benefit that can be cashed in, so it is an annual incentive and certainly would be a contractual expectation for the term of the contract. With regard, Chief Justice, to the representations that were made by Mr. Cohen, contractual tenure for a non-certificated custodian. There is both a statutory provision that provides for the accrual of stature and for the accrual of tenure, and there's also the ability to negotiate contractual tenure. Once that contractual tenure is negotiated, it becomes a right for that employee. And I would be of the opinion that that would be tantamount to a statutory right for tenure, that it has the same legal efficacy as would be granted under the tenure statute. As distinguished from all of these other rights, and with regard to Justice Albin's several questions about the ambiguity of this contract language, I would first point out
for a second and ask you to explain the distinction in your mind between that form of right that vests and this case.
So with regard to contractual tenure, that is an individual right that would vest in terms of your job security. That That right, I believe, is an alternative to statutory tenure, so I think it takes on that same significance legally, as opposed to all of these other benefits that do not begin to rise to that level. So I see that as being entirely different than sick days, vacation days. And I would also take the position that with regard to that contractual vesting, it happens at that moment in time. So if the contractual tenure benefit is that you get contractual tenure after 3, 4, or 5 years, and I've seen that in many contracts for custodial maintenance employees, once you have accrued those years of service, that contractual tenure entitlement vests. Here, this right doesn't vest until you retire. And so that becomes operative, and that is clearly a distinction between these two rights.
And contractual tenure, as you're describing it, I mean, statutory tenure is regarded as a property right, an immediate property right. Is a contractual tenure provision the equivalent immediate property right held by the employee who may claim that protection against any employer action?
I would acknowledge that it is. Justice Albin, you asked a number of questions with regard to the contract language and whether it is clear, and you correctly pointed to the savings clause of the contract. That clause of the contract clearly says that the benefits continue during the term of that agreement, and that was the 2012 agreement. It also goes on to say that unless otherwise provided in this agreement, nothing shall be interpreted to eliminate, reduce, or otherwise detract from any benefit. And so then I think you must look to the duration clause. I think you must read them in paramateria. And under the duration clause, clearly those benefits continue until the next contract is negotiated. I would also say, Justice Albin, that if there was a question with regard to the ambiguity of the contract, and if in fact these plaintiffs and their majority representative believe that the contract was ambiguous, they had recourse to the grievance and arbitration procedure of this contract. They certainly could have claimed that there was an ambiguity in the contract language and that ambiguity should be resolved in their favor to receive a benefit based on what you've characterized as an express omission of an express waiver of that benefit. I would respectfully submit to you that, and Justice Patterson asked this question many times, I would respectfully submit to you that there is no reasonably debatable argument that the union knew what it was doing here, that the extrinsic evidence clearly supports that. I heard counsel indicate that there was nothing on this record to support that. There's an entire transcript of a deposition proceeding of the union president in which she does indeed outline each step of the negotiations process. Clearly, they understood what they were doing in exchange for what they were able to extract from the public employer.
If you think the employees had an individual grievance right, why didn't you make that argument in front of Judge Cantillo and say the jurisdiction really should have been in front of an arbitrator?
As I stand here, I'm not sure whether we did make that argument, and I think we might have. But I
just didn't see that discussion in the trial court's opinion.
Right. I don't know whether or not we made that argument. We may have, Justice Lavecchia, but I don't specifically recall.
Is that still a remedy here?
No. That remedy has been lost through the passage of time. Thank you.
I'm going to underscore very briefly. Please come to the center. And then Mr. Fogarty gets a response if he needs it.
What I want to say is if you take the 25 years and you say, I need to have 10 years.
No, please keep your voice.
I'm sorry. I need to have 25 years and I have to retire. I would say that that's grossly unfair and not really in accord with what we have viewed as vested rights. That would mean a person could work 24 years and on the eve of retirement find out the formula that they'd been promised and the reason they have not taken the sick leave would be worthless or worth less. It might even be worth nothing if they decide to take it out of the contract. So it really makes no sense to, respectfully, it makes no sense to say that I have to get to retirement and work 25 years before this contract could be honored. Otherwise, the benefit could very well be worthless. The appropriate place is the appropriate milestone is the 10 years, which is what the contract says. And to say that unless I make it to retirement, the benefit's not vested, it means I've earned nothing, or I could earn nothing.
We understand your argument.
Pardon?
We have your argument and understand it. Thank you, Mr. Fogarty. Nothing on that?
I have no response.
Thank you. And